Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I'm a former middle school teacher, current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so on this podcast, I share ideas and strategies. I talk about things that worked, but also those big epic fails that I've made along the way. And ultimately, because I believe that teachers play a profound role in helping students reach their creative potential. And so before we get started, we're gonna be talking about assessment this week. I just wanna share that we recently launched Boost PBL. We have short little sprints, mini projects, which lasts about a week, and then full-blown PBL. It is for K through 8, and we are working on a whole bunch of new projects as well. If you are interested in it, go check out boostpbl.com. Our goal is to make project-based learning feasible. We want to keep the standards high. We want to provide protocols for students that build on voice and choice and agency. And we want to do all of that while making sure that students actually master the standards through the project-based learning. So again, go to boostpbl.com. You can find out more about it. And there's options not only for you individually as an educator, but also some discounts in terms of school-wide and district-wide licenses as well. So again, please check out boostpbl.com and see what kinds of projects we are offering. Without further ado, let's jump right into this week's episode. So, years ago, gosh, this had to be a little over 20 years ago, I shifted toward this idea of empowering my students with voice and choice. And I asked myself the question, what am I doing for students that they could be doing for themselves? And one of the most glaring answers for me was assessment. So I began to incorporate peer and self-assessment, but actually it began with kind of a rocky start. And I'm gonna share my epic fail first so that maybe you can avoid some of the mistakes I made along the way. So I had this vision of doing a writer's workshop, and I thought it would look like the writer's workshop of my college years, where everyone would be poring over drafts and saying comments like, have you considered blank, or I appreciate the way you used this phrase here. They would lean in intently, offer their own thoughts, and jot down a few ideas and next steps. After some back and forth, they would switch roles and engage in the same back and forth feedback process. This would be practical, it would be instant, and it would improve the clarity of their writing and perhaps even some better word choice. They might argue over ideas and sharpen their logic and argumentation. And the workshop would be this buzz of excitement followed by those small lulls of silence as students revised their draft. I had this picture of my mind what it would look like. Well, I began the first class with a warm-up where students wrote about the value of peer feedback. And after a short discussion, I said, you'll need to find a partner who will read your work and then give you feedback. Take as long as you need, then you can switch and find a new partner. I explained that this was how writers helped one another improve. This was a process professional writers used on a regular basis. And now they would be part of that larger collective of writers who would help one another improve their craft. 10 minutes later, I watched as students wandered around the room. A few students pulled out their phones. This was pre-smartphones, so if you imagine flip phones, and they started texting their friends. They talked about fantasy football or fashion or TV shows or video games or, well, pretty much everything but their writing. A few students shot paper footballs at the ceilings. And gradually, the class moved from a hum to an ear-splitting roar. I quieted them down and instituted a no-moving rule and added a timer for accountability, but it was still kind of a waste of a class. Then it was the next class period, period two, and the students took the peer feedback process a little more seriously. I reminded them of the expectations to stay focused, everything you can imagine, but the feedback they gave was actually just way too nice. It was a lot of, this is great, it's really good, have I told you how good it is? Great job. It was like cotton candy feedback. It was vague, amorphous, and overly sweet, but ultimately lacking any real substance. In the third period, students were not giving cotton candy feedback. It was more like giant shards of glass. A few students made comments like, "This sucks. None of your sentences even have periods." Two students refused to talk to each other. Three students were in tears. And at one point, a student jumped up and pushed his desk at the other student. And, well, the writer's workshop wasn't working. By lunchtime, I scrapped this idea entirely and had students use a checklist for self-assessment instead. Not a bad strategy, but not what I was looking for. Now, looking back on it, I wasn't wrong in my vision for quality peer feedback, but I didn't communicate that vision to students. I didn't model for them what it looked like. I didn't have structures and systems set up. I didn't have any kind of soft accountability. And so I want to talk about seven strategies for getting the most out of peer feedback in the classroom. Number one, make sure the students are beginning with a place of trust. So I like to imagine this idea of peer feedback from low trust to high trust. So I want you to envision this continuum, low trust, high trust. And then I want you to imagine right in the middle, you have this other continuum. So it's almost like an X and a Y axis. And the X axis is going to be, you know, low trust to high trust from left to right. And then from bottom to top, we have negative feedback at the bottom, positive feedback at the top. If you have low trust and positive feedback, that's flattery. It feels good, but it's not good feedback. If you have low trust and negative feedback, that's hating. And to quote the great Taylor Swift, the haters are gonna hate, 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 hate. If you have high trust and negative feedback, that's critical feedback. It doesn't feel good, but it's necessary. It's part of how we grow. And then if we have high trust and positive feedback, that's affirmation, and we need that. It's really important as we say this, though, to recognize that we need to tap into whether or not students actually trust each other. So we can do things like surveys where we say on a scale of 1 to 5, how well do you trust your groups? On a scale of 1 to 5, how well do you trust group members to complete tasks? On a scale of 1 to 5, how well do you trust your group members' expertise or their knowledge about the content? And that helps you figure out this notion of trust. I'm gonna add something else about negative feedback and positive feedback. We all have something called a negativity bias. And so we actually really need to make sure that when it comes to doing feedback, right? Making sure that we are providing feedback, we need to keep the ratio at about 5 to 1. That might seem a little bit intense, but 5 positives to 1 negative. And that's really important that we recognize that negativity will cause people to not hear the positives if we do this 1-to-1 ratio. If I tell you this is good, this is bad, you won't hear the good along with the bad. You'll just hear the bad. It takes about 5 positives to 1 negative for it to actually work. And so we really want to recognize that the ratio has to be good. Number two, use structures to guide the peer feedback process. My first writer's workshop had no clear structure. Students weren't sure what they were supposed to do. I was afraid that structure would make things less authentic. And so I didn't provide the parameters needed. And it became a free-for-all, right? It was this absolute confusion and chaos the entire time. Students spent the whole time chatting or wandering around. And later, I started to think about feedback in real life. True, there are times where it's unstructured, definitely. But if we take a deeper look at the seemingly unstructured peer feedback, we'll notice that there's often a pattern or a system. A friend asks for your opinion. You spend time looking at their work. You ask questions. You give strengths, weaknesses. Well, guess what's happening right there? You have a protocol, a system that you are using. On a more formal level, people sometimes use structures because of the limitations of the protocol actually facilitates better feedback. So what we're doing is we're using protocols to guide the process. One of my favorite examples has time deadlines It's very clear. It leads them into an actionable state of taking the feedback and using it. And it's what I call the 20-minute peer feedback system. If you go to spencereducation.com, you check out the blog post and the article connected to this, what you'll find is there is a video with the 20-minute peer feedback process, and you can watch the entire video to see what it's like. But there's also structured feedback with sentence stems. You give them sentence stems, and you can create these sentence stems using AI. I mean, that's one of the nice things about integrating AI into the curriculum. There's also glows and grows. This is simple. 5 glows or positive forms of feedback. 1 grows. The suggestion of what to do for improvements. There's the feedback carousel where groups are going to give feedback to one another from table to table to table. They provide feedback on sticky notes and it's timed. Then we have something a little looser like peer coaching where they're going to take the time to sort of coach each other with some guiding questions. There's the mastermind process, which is very structured but very student-centered, and it's a little bit more open. And then things like using rubrics or checklists to just grade one another or check off how things are going. And so that's the notion of using these structures for feedback. And one of the goals is that we really want it to fit the type of feedback they need for the particular assignment that they're working on. So sometimes we'll go more open-ended at first and then more specific. Sometimes we'll go more specific and then more open-ended in different rounds of feedback. So the protocols can be used strategically and intentionally. All right, let's move to number 3, which is explain the purpose of feedback. So what we're thinking about here is a series of questions. What type of feedback will you give and receive? Is it about the process or about the product? Is it about accuracy or is it about knowledge? Is it about a particular skill? That's really important. What type of feedback do you want to give? Also, what are the key areas you want to focus on? In writing, it might be word choice. In design thinking, it might be feedback on the research. You know, whatever it may be, math, it could be problem solving, but it could also be conceptual understanding. What will students do with the feedback? Remind them ahead of time of what they're going to do when they get it. In other words, how will the students use the feedback that they're doing? How does the feedback tie to the learning outcomes? How does it connect to the mastery of the standards? So you might provide students with feedback on their ability to use the design thinking process in a project, or you might provide feedback on their current product that they're working on. And they need to know, are we focused on product or process, right? If students are judging a performance, they should learn how to ask, how can I improve it next time, rather than how did I do? If they want more specific, actionable feedback. And by the way, that last one comes from Adam Grant, who has a great book and just phenomenal thinker in organizational psychology. And I loved what he has to say about feedback. Students need to know both the parameters of the feedback and the rationale. And so that's really important that we're setting the tone by explaining the purpose of feedback. Number 4, I'm gonna just say this, it's gonna be unpopular, I don't care. Don't allow students to grade one another. It is critical that peer feedback doesn't become peer grading. The problem with peer grading is that it creates this power dynamic that's just not good. You as the educator, as the teacher, as the one in the classroom should be the one deciding the grades. Students aren't trained in assessment. They're not trained in grading, but also, they're not always mature enough to actually grade accurately to one another. So what happens is if they start grading each other, it creates sometimes competition, sometimes mistrust. There's just a lot of things that you don't want to do. You want to take grading away from assessment when it comes to peer grading and just focus on peer assessment. All right, let's move on to the next one, which is going to be number 5. And that is provide revision time. Often in education, we value speed and accuracy more than we do depth and mastery. Students take timed math tests that focus on fluency in reading, for example. They watch time deadlines, knowing that if they fall behind, they'll be seen as slow. I've seen students who struggle with the idea of revision time because they're worried about, you know, looking dumb. And so it's really important that we give them time and we build it into it. And it is an expectation that everyone will revise their work. No one's going to do it perfectly right the first time. And if you think it's good enough the first time, then either you need an extension activity to work on, right? Some kind of enrichment. And maybe you have mastered what you're working on. Maybe you have done a phenomenal job and it's time to move on. Or maybe it's time to admit that you could improve, you could do better. It can help to ask your students the question, what are you going to do with the feedback? Often they struggle with this. In their schooling experiences, they have typically received a grade and walked away without thinking much about it. And this approach focuses on using feedback in a way that's much more self-directed. You can even provide the sentence frame. I really like this. I plan to use blank feedback to change blank. Or another option might be, one valuable piece of feedback is blank. I plan to blank to improve my blank. So again, this is the notion of giving them time. It can be tough, right? Classes crowded, the time schedules, it can be super fast. But it's the notion of building in some revision time. Number six, set parameters and expectations for feedback. If I think about that disastrous writer's workshop example I gave earlier, students were giving harsh feedback in that one class period. And some of it was a lack of trust, but also I had failed to set expectations around language. And so it's really important that we have them develop a set of norms or behavioral expectations for their feedback. Yes, we want them to own the feedback process, but we also need them to follow some guidelines. And you can empower students even more by bringing them into the conversation about the norms, like they can help come up with the norms together. Or you could set the norms ahead of time for them, you know, depending on grade level, class maturity, that type of thing. And this is things like respectful language, active listening, focused participation, being prepared, you know, staying on topic. Any of those would be the types of norms that you would provide. And then number seven, I think this part is the piece that I really failed to do in my classroom. And I wish I had done this that first time. We just need to model and practice the peer feedback process. Great feedback doesn't always come naturally. Look, it's something that students have to learn through practice. And that shouldn't surprise us. Consider how many people you know who are awful at giving or receiving critical feedback. For this reason, you might just have to model this with students. The younger they are, the more likely you're going to need to do that. And it works best to have a confident student that's willing to get some critical feedback come up to the front of the class, and you just model it with them. And again, focus five positives, one critical piece, so they know that everyone is going to get feedback that is actionable, specific, positive, but also critical. To help reduce cognitive load, you might break down a peer feedback protocol, and you'll do a first step, and then they'll do the first step with a partner. Second step, third step, fourth step. You'll have an anchor chart up that they can look at. You might have a PowerPoint slide that they can look at. And you're modeling it for them in a way that reduces cognitive load. In the end, peer feedback isn't easy, right? And that's part of why so many teachers don't use any peer feedback whatsoever. But if we can embrace these best practices, students can own that peer assessment process, and in the end, improve their learning and their metacognition and grow. Hey, thank you so much for listening to this podcast. Would you do me a favor? If you enjoy it, would you consider leaving a review on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify or wherever it is that you get your podcast? Also, don't forget to subscribe and maybe tell a friend about this podcast as well. If you don't follow me, you can look at my blog at spencereducation.com. You can join my newsletter as well. That's another way that we can connect. Again, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.